I have a habit of running into the question and answer time that I'd like to reserve for the end, so let's go ahead and begin. I was very pleased this year to have three students of mine from Wofford College here this week. I told them, don't show up to my lectures. Please don't come to my lectures, because you can always get this stuff back at Wofford and in the classroom, but some of them have persisted in trying to appear. I teach at a small college in Spartanburg, South Carolina, and the students there are very bright and motivated, and yet if you start to explain to them what Mises University is, and you say, well, it's like a week of economics summer camp, and you go to lectures and you talk to professors and scholars and you talk to other students who are interested in Austrian economics, and of course their eyes are glazing over and they're starting to think, well, why on earth would you want to go talk to somebody about economics for a week and read these books by people they've never heard of, like Rothbard and Mises and or Mises, as you're likely to hear from you talk to. Who is this Mises person? You're a special crowd. It's a particular pleasure to me to be able to talk about these kinds of things to people who are genuinely interested. Even though I'm very happy with my normal students at Wofford, you just can't carry on the same kind of lectures. I mean, this kind of lecture is, it's a lot more fun in front of a crowd like you. You get stuff like this. You've seen this maybe circulating around Facebook or something like that. This is state bingo, and I saw this maybe a year ago. So every time you hear one of these arguments on Facebook or Twitter or something, you have to put a little marker in one of these boxes. And so who will build the roads? Well, that was Walter Block's on the last lecture, right? So that you always hear this, like somehow the market can't handle this because the market hasn't been allowed to handle this, so therefore it can't. So I don't know where the logic in that is, but without government, all business would turn into one big monopoly. I don't know how many science fiction dystopia kinds of movies there have been where the whole world is run by some huge umbrella corporation, and it's a one giant monopoly, and everybody is subservient to the big private firm. Somehow government itself maintaining a monopoly over money and monopoly over roads and monopoly over communications or various other things, that just doesn't count because that's government. Everybody knows the government is trying to do something for your good. And if you don't recognize that it's for your good, well, that's because you're an uninformed troglodyte who needs to get out of the Stone Age. Bob Higgs, I don't know that he's talking about the FDA this week. I didn't see. I know he's talking about the war, propensity of governments to war. But he's well known for talking about this one right below the star here. If we get rid of the FDA, there will be rat poison in our medications. Let's go through some of these. I think it's important for you to have a familiarity with some of the, at least a starting point for how we might address some of the common objections to capitalism. And by the way, I'm using the term capitalism. I actually prefer free markets. Capitalism is a word that was developed by Karl Marx, Das Kapital, and he talked more about capitalism than he did about communism. And I actually prefer free markets. I think that has some advantages against the term capitalism. But we'll stick with this for now. One argument is that capitalism exploits the poor. And if you take a sociology class or you take a history class or a lot of economics classes, you're going to see these kinds of images. Little kids working on textile machinery and crawling through coal mines. And you've seen maybe the picture of the young Welsh kids who are coated in coal dust and carrying their lunch pails because they've been down in the mines all day. And we get this idea that capitalism is exploitative of the poor. Well, one of the things we don't really see in these images is that these kids who are doing these horrible tasks, I mean horrible from our modern point of view, these are kids some of whom would have died in the era before the Industrial Revolution, which was a blossoming of free markets. Mises, in his book Economic Policy, which is a great little book, very easy to read, and if somebody asks you, well, what's a short, accessible book that I can read on economics? That's one of those that would be in my short list. So Mises says in that little book, he says, you know, the population of this planet is now 10 times greater than it was in the ages preceding capitalism. Now it'd be much more because he was writing this in the 50s. You know that all men today enjoy a higher standard of living than your ancestors did before the age of capitalism. But how do you know that you are the one out of 10 who would have lived in the absence of capitalism? The mere fact that you are living today is proof that capitalism has succeeded, whether or not you consider your own life very valuable. And he goes on to talk about the initial objections to capitalism among the landed gentry, the aristocracy of England. Why were they upset with capitalism? They saw their workers, who were supposed to stay on their landed their estates and work for them. They saw the workers moving into the urban areas and working in the factories because the conditions were better. The pay was better. As bad as it was by modern standards, it was better. So the aristocracy began to attack the urban factories and the industries by criticizing the standard of living of the masses of workers. Mises says, the famous old story, repeated hundreds of times, that the factories employed women and children, and that, oh my, we wouldn't want that, would we, right? Because, at least, you know, the women part. Children today are not normally working in factories because they have better alternatives. They did not have those better alternatives in the days before before capitalism. The idea that factory labor should not employ women, this was an argument not of free marketers. This was an argument of the those who were objecting to the competition. Factory labor gave women a comparative advantage that had not been available to them in wage earning occupations before. So capitalism improved the opportunities for women. Anyway, Mises says, before these women and children were working in factories, they were not living in satisfactory conditions. He says, the mothers who worked in the factories had nothing to cook with. They did not leave their homes and their kitchens to go into the factories. They went into the factories because they had no kitchens. And if they had a kitchen, they had no food to cook in those kitchens. And the children did not come from comfortable nurseries. They were starving and dying. And all the talk about the so-called unspeakable horror of early capitalism can be refuted by a single statistic. Precisely in these years in which British capitalism developed, precisely in the age called the Industrial Revolution in England, precisely in those years, the population of England doubled, which means that hundreds or thousands of children who would have died in preceding times survived and grew to become men and women. And we get this kind of talk from anti-capitalists that we shouldn't introduce capitalism to developing countries because it will ruin their culture or it will destroy their way of life or something of that nature. And so it sounds a lot like they want to maintain these kind of poverty zoos so that you can go see the traditional way of life, which is a traditional way of life that ends up having a life expectancy of 40 and given the opportunity to change that way of life, given the range of choices made available by a market, many of the people in these societies decide they'd like to live past 40 or 45. They'd like to stop dying see their children stop dying in infancy. All right. If you look at the idea that capitalism exploits the poor, look at what capitalism or free markets have done for the poor. Today, if you are a poor American, if you're below the poverty line, 99% of those in that category have electricity, running water, flush toilets, a refrigerator. 95% have a television. I think that's actually higher now. 88% have a telephone, 71% have a car, and 70% have air conditioning. Cornelius Vanderbilt had none of these. If you look at this index of economic freedom, I use this sometimes in my classes, and I show, this is an index done by the Fraser Institute every so often. I don't think it's annual, but the most recent data is from about 2010. And they say, well, let's look at the impact of economic freedom, that is to say, more free markets. Let's look at the impact of that on the poor. So they say, well, how much, what fraction of the total income is earned by the poorest 10%? And we find this, and they've divided countries up into quartiles, so the bottom 25%, the next 25%, and so forth. And we find that the most free countries, that's the blue bar there, the poorest 10% have about 2.75% of the income. Maybe in your class you've had something like a Gini coefficient or something like that, where this is kind of the same concept. The least free, about 2.56%. Not a whole lot of difference in the share of income across countries with varying levels of economic freedom. But 2.75% of a lot is a whole lot more than 2.56 of a little. So if you look at the actual income level of the poor, we see this. In the most free countries, the poorest 10% have an income of about $11,400 a year. And in the least free countries, it's about $1,200 a year. Far better to be poor, that is, in the bottom 10%, in a relatively free country, a relatively free market-oriented regime. Evidently, capitalism has lifted the poor out of poverty. Now, there's a lot more to it than just these simple correlations, and we could get into some of the other factors that might affect these distributions of wealth. But it doesn't seem that capitalism is adversely affecting the poor at all. You get this idea that capitalism is unjust. Mises says, this is a delusion that the poor are needy only because unjust people have deprived them of their birthright, and it's the task of the authorities to prevent this spoilation and to make all people prosperous. He says every word of that is false. Nature is not bountiful, it's stingy. We're faced with scarcity at every turn. We are faced with a restricted supply of the things that we would like to have for our well-being and for eating and shelter and clothing and all of these basic necessities. Mises says that nature has populated the world with animals and plants to whom the impulse to destroy human life and welfare is inwrought. It displays powers and elements whose operation is damaging to human life and to human endeavors to preserve it. So he says the truth is that the accumulation of capital and its investment in machines, the source of the relatively greater wealth of the Western peoples, is due exclusively to laissez-faire capitalism. So we have this concern about wealth distribution. We have this concern commonly about capitalism and wealth creation, and we find that, in fact, it is unfounded. Hayek said that once the rise in the position of the lower classes gathers speed, catering to the rich ceases to be the main source of great gain and gives place to efforts directed towards the needs of the masses. Those forces which at first make inequality self-accentuating thus later tend to diminish it. Well, let's think about this inequality. We see several things going on in societies that are developing and moving toward more industrialization and moving maybe toward freer markets, we do see that there's an increased global specialization of labor, which leads to a kind of superstar effect. That is, if I'm really good at what I do, I can sell my services or my product to a global audience, not just a local audience. We see this in, say, the performing arts. So if you're an actor in 1800 or 1850, or even 1900, you can't sell your acting services to a crowd that's larger than those who can physically be present at your performance. And now with the improvement of technology, you can sell your services globally. And so we have movie stars instead of thousands and thousands of actors and dancers and other performers. We now have a smaller number of really superstar performers. So there is that effect that may increase inequality. We get increased immigration in some countries, so the immigrants tend to be poorer than the average, and they tend to move into a country and increase that inequality. We see that high earners tend to marry each other much more often than they once did. That has an effect. But we also see some other effects that tend to diminish inequality. One is that IQ score spreads are shrinking, not because the higher intelligence group is losing intelligence, but because people who, for some reason, had lower intelligence, those scores tend to be rising. Again, this is a lifting of the bottom rather than suppression of the top. We find if you look at kind of rough estimates of nutrition and health, we also see a reduction in inequality. British aristocrats were 6 inches taller than average in 1800. Today, they're less than 2 inches taller than average. So there's a diminishing of that inequality as the Industrial Revolution has progressed, as we see more and more market progress toward markets. Well, another argument is that capitalism doesn't make us happy. So, yeah, you're rich, but you're on Prozac, and you've got these kind of suicidal tendencies, and you're depressed, and you've got neuroses, and you're anxious, and you're just all wound up tight because of the pressure put on you by the market system to produce and to work and to earn and to keep up with the Joneses and so forth. There was an argument, an older argument, started in the 1970s, and this has been repeated and repeated and repeated, that the wealthier countries of the world are not necessarily happier countries. Now, measuring happiness is a difficult thing to do at best. But to the extent that we can look at some kind of research on this, there was a 1974 study by Richard Easterlin that showed, apparently, that there's a paradox. The wealthier countries aren't happy, and the poorer countries are happy. And poor countries, of course, latched onto this and said, oh, see, we're poor, but we're happy. And so Bhutan is one of the more common examples of a country that said, well, we're going to have a gross happiness index. And instead of looking at GDP, and we recognize we're not so good in that category, we're going to look at how happy we are and see, we're poor, but we're really, really happy. Now, I'm not a big fan of GDP. I really am not. There's all kinds of problems with GDP and using that as a measure of economic progress. Nevertheless, this so-called Easterlin paradox has been challenged more recently. There were two studies that came out in 2008 that show that this paradox doesn't exist. Rich people are happier than poor people. Rich countries have happier people than poor countries. People get happier as they get richer. Matt Ridley has pointed all of this out in his book, The Rational Optimist, and he said that The earlier study, the one that gave rise to the so-called Easterlin paradox, simply had a sample size that was too small to produce any significant results. So there, I still have students who bring this up, and they say, when we're talking about GDP, and they say, "Well, you know, you can't use GDP to make these assessments of how well off or how badly off a country is because of this. It's not capturing happiness." But to the extent that we can look at it, it seems that in fact there is a positive correlation. Again, I'm not advocating GDP as some kind of supreme measure of how well off we are, but it's something anyway. If you ask the poor, do you want a longer, healthier life? Do you want better education? Do you want your children to survive past age 5? Do you want a more varied and a more consistent diet? Do you want easier communication with your family and friends? Do you want more square footage of shelter? Do you want the ability to travel and see new places? All of those things which people seem to be drawn to as their income rises, all of those things are made more possible. Scarcity problem is diminished to some extent by markets. I'm going to skip this in the interest of time. Mises, in Human Action, you may want to look this up later, had a few comments to say about happiness, that human action is the striving for happiness. So the more free people are to pursue their own actions and their own goals, the more likely they will be to be happy. Well, one of the arguments that I've seen that just strikes me as a misunderstanding of economics, a complete misunderstanding, is this idea that capitalism puts economics before people. I had asked that if you go online and you look at the materials for this lecture, that an article by Cameron Mofeed be posted. It is critical of markets, and in fact, there's a couple of articles that I've posted there that are critical of markets. I want you to read the other side. I want you to be familiar with those arguments. But Mofeed says, well, economic thinking is flawed because it doesn't account for other goals. He defines economism as primarily as economic systems in which economic considerations alone govern choice and decisions. What is economics? It's a development or a particularly well-developed subset of praxeology. What is praxeology? Day one of this week. What is it? Study of human action, human choices, human decisions. Every decision you make is an action. And economics is a study of those actions. You are facing scarcity. Economics is a way of examining that scarcity and seeing how you make decisions in the face of it. So to restrict, as Mofeed seems to want to do, to restrict economics to something relating to dollars or money and so forth is to misunderstand what economics is all about. It is a wide range of decision making. You can have economics in a society with no money. Robinson Crusoe on an island by himself is making economic decisions. Even though he's not trading, even though there's no money, he's still making economic decisions. He confronts scarcity and he has to make decisions. He faces opportunity cost. He looks at different alternatives. That's economics. Well, then you get this argument that capitalism is deadly, that it is it destroys life, that corporations are inclined to do us harm, that we are trapped by markets into buying products that are bad for us. And this is an image of a Ford Pinto. If you take a business ethics class, you're most likely going to end up studying this case. Ford Motor Company produced this inexpensive car in the 1970s called a Pinto. Very cheap. It became infamous because there was a tragic accident in the Midwest in which three young girls were killed on a highway. They had stopped for some reason in the middle of the highway at night. I think they were going back to look for a lost gas cap or something. And they were struck from behind, and the gas tank ruptured, and all three died, which is a tragedy. And I don't want to be flip about anything I'm going to say here about this kind of thing, but the Ford Motor Company was accused of pursuing profits instead of safety. That they should have produced a gas tank or located the gas tank, or they could have made some kind of modification that would have cost, I don't remember what it was, some seemingly trivial amount per car that would have avoided the rupturing of the gas tank and avoided the deaths and so forth. And yet, safety is a scarce good. We have to make trade-offs. You make multiple trade-offs every day when you decide to take various actions. You make trade-offs which indicate that your life is not viewed by you as being infinitely valuable. Many of you traveled a long distance to come here. Could you have lost your life in that process, over that distance, driving down the road? I drove 3.5 hours, 4 hours down the road from where I am to here. Very dangerous. I'm driving through Atlanta in the rain, 80 miles an hour or something like that. So it's a small risk, but it is a risk nonetheless. I made a trade-off. I decided that being here and doing what I'm doing here is more valuable than the little risk that I took to my life, which indicates that my life is not infinitely valuable, and yet we want to hold Ford Motor Company as ethically responsible for these deaths because they took account of that that finitely valuable life in their own decisions, engineering decisions. Another argument is that capitalism is aesthetically obnoxious and environmentally irresponsible. I talked yesterday about the Austrian view of environmental issues, and I'm assuming that lecture's been recorded. You can go back and look at that if you like. I'm just going to say a few things here about this. But this is one of those issues that sometimes stumps market advocates. We think, oh, well, yeah, I mean, I talk to students who will say this. I'm kind of in favor of markets, and I think markets are great, but we need to have some government regulation to prevent these kind of things like the BP oil spill. And if we'd had enough regulation, then those things wouldn't have happened. And if we had enough regulation, then, you know, Fukushima wouldn't have happened, or whatever. You pick your environmental catastrophe. If we just had a little more government involvement, then we could have avoid these things. Mises, in his book, The Anti-Capitalist Mentality, says, only romantic prepossession can induce an observer to ignore the fact that more and more citizens of the capitalistic countries live in an environment which cannot be simply dismissed as ugly. And I've had discussions with people about things like urban sprawl and the argument that markets produce this terrible blight on our landscape. And I wrote an article some years ago for Freeman on this urban sprawl, if you want to take a look at that. But I was answering, in a way, an objection from a colleague of mine who took some students on a trip up and down the East Coast of the United States. And he said that there were just strip malls and burger joints and big box development, Home Depot type stores and other things that he just thought were aesthetically obnoxious. Now, you can address this in several ways. You can say, well, let's persuade people not to go to the coast, and then there will be no need to build restaurants to feed them, and no need to build housing to shelter them, and no need to put up these tacky beach stores that sell rafts and tubes and various other kind of beachy stuff, little tacky souvenirs made out of seashells and things like that. No need for all of that because nobody will be there. Very few people will be there because we persuaded everybody to stay away. Well, that's one thing you could do. Lots of luck with that. Another thing you could do is to buy the land that would otherwise go to a hamburger store or the tacky souvenir shop or a restaurant or the hotel, and you can just say, I don't care if you offer me $20 million per square foot, we're just not going to sell it. And that way you can keep people from developing the land. That's the method preferred by groups like the Nature Conservancy. People will give them land and say, we're going to put this in trust and nobody can build on it. It's going to remain undeveloped. And that's expensive. I mean, you have to resist that opportunity cost of using land for something that people are clearly willing to pay a lot for. Alternatively, the government could prevent people from exercising their preferences by restricting development in a number of ways. Now, the restrictions can limit the availability of housing. They can limit the access to natural attractions. I read recently about Oregon's long-standing law that says that the entire beach, entire coastline of Oregon, apparently is government-owned, and you can't put a private dock or a pier into the Pacific. You have to leave this untouched. Well, there's a large opportunity cost to this, and if land is restricted, then beaches are going to end up turning into more the domain of the wealthy than they now are. I mean, you limit the supply of something, the price tends to go up. I'm not saying I'm pro-urban sprawl. I mean, I like open space and I like natural environments. I really do. I enjoy going out and hiking and camping and trying to push my kids out of the living room and into wilderness areas to get them outdoors. I really enjoy that myself. But I'm not going to say that that sprawl has some kind of ethical problem. And neither can I say that I know exactly how a market society would come out on these kinds of things. Would we have more sprawl or less sprawl if government backed out of the land use decisions that it's now making? I mean, government, at the same time that it's restricting use, is also subsidizing use in other cases. They extend sewer lines and require people to tap into the sewer line and water lines. They build roads into areas that are undeveloped and subsidize that development in that way. They use eminent domain power to seize property and turn it over to another developer to use for some kind of more intensive development. I mean, governments are in the business of accelerating sprawl at least as much as they're in the business of restricting it. So I don't really know on balance which way the government whether the government is on net encouraging it or discouraging it. Be difficult to say. But you do see this. I mean, this is kind of government housing. On the left, you've got Uzbekistan, and on the right, you've got Kazakhstan. And I've taken several trips to Eastern and Central Europe, and I've seen some of the kind of leftover architecture of state-run regimes, and it tends to not be very attractive. It tends to, preferences are your own. I mean, you can decide. If you think that's attractive, then more power to you. I look at that and I think that's, what's that? I'm sorry? Yes. It's, And I don't even know what the insides of these apartments look like, but I imagine they're small and probably look about as shabby as the outside. But you're really going to look at this and say, well, this is state-organized, state-run, state-designed structures. And this is preferable? Really? We have this kind of hubris among state bureaucrats that they know how to run things, and they know how to make things better. And yet, if you compare this to the typical neighborhood in, say, a more market-oriented country, like some of the countries in Western Europe, relatively speaking, then you get something that, at least to my eyes, looks a little more attractive. Again, there's values are subjective, and it's difficult to make, I would say impossible to make, definitive statements about this. One of the things that I've used sometimes in my classes is this relationship between income and environmental deterioration. Again, measuring environmental deterioration is difficult, but this is called an environmental Kuznets curve. It's been around since, came into common discussion in the early 90s, maybe late 80s. And we see that there's a relationship between income and the level of pollution in society. And this is, let me back up here. What we see on the horizontal axis there is the amount of income measured by GDP per capita. And on the vertical axis, we've got environmental deterioration. So the environmental Kuznets curve indicates that as income increases per person, we will tend to see more environmental deterioration. But eventually, we reach a turning point. And at that turning point, further improvement in our incomes will tend to reduce environmental deterioration. And that's what we've seen. Now, you talk to a lot of people, and they say, "Well, you know, we don't have Pittsburgh is not as dirty as it once was because of the EPA." And I would suggest that environmental improvement in some categories began long before the EPA showed up on the scene. In fact, in some ways, I would argue that government regulation has made the environment dirtier. It's not just that regulation is sort of matching the tendency for people to improve their environment on their own. It actually is holding it back in some ways. But here's some examples, and this is some rough estimates of the turning points, where that turning point is for various pollutants, so that after you reach an income of about this level, any further improvement in your income is going to reduce the levels of these pollutants. I would quibble with the idea that carbon dioxide is a pollutant, more than quibble, but it's on the list. Regardless, you look at carbon monoxide, far less controversial, or nitrates, sulfur dioxide. Take sulfur dioxide. Apparently, in 2001 dollars, once your per capita GDP reaches about $9,000 to $11,000, any further increase in per capita GDP is going to mean a reduction in sulfur dioxide, SO2. Suspended particulates, 24,000 or 25,000 to about 30,000. Once you're past that point, suspended particulates are going to drop off. It's not the same in every country. It's not the same in these estimates may be off to some extent, but it does appear that there's a point where further improvements in your economy tend to reduce pollution. It's not a continuing upward movement. And if you look at the level of pollution in times past, when people look at cars today and they say, "Oh, cars, they're just such polluters." And think about all the noxious gases coming out of the tailpipe, and nitrous oxides and the particulates and the carbon dioxide or whatever else they're objecting, carbon monoxide, whatever else they're objecting to that comes out of the tailpipe of a car. Well, what did cars replace? Horses. Horses. So you've got, what, 1,500 pounds of stuff that's going to walk around for a while, and then it's going to die and leave a carcass. Is that healthy? Is that, you know? Not only that, but all through its life, it is leaving solid and liquid waste all over the city streets, which, since you're not driving around and there's a lot more pedestrian traffic, you're going to track this into your houses. And when it's dry outside, all the traffic and the foot traffic and so forth is going to pulverize this horse manure into a fine dust, which is going to go into your house because you don't have air conditioning, so your windows are open and mom's pumpkin pie is sitting on the windowsill cooling, and so you get little particles of horse manure on mom's pie. And then not to mention that you not only have the direct effects of this horse manure and horse urine all over the city streets that's being tracked into houses and buildings and pulverized and breathed into your lungs and carries various microbes with it. You also have to consider the environmental effect of having to grow barley and oats and whatever else horses eat out on fields outside the city. So you're using land for this purpose. You're using clean water resources to devote to these animals. You want to compare the pollution of an automobile to the pollution of a horse? I would suggest that the horse is probably a more polluting entity. Or mode of transportation, certainly per mile. So what we have today is a vast improvement in many regards to times past. The BP oil spill. We look at this as, or a lot of people look at this as some kind of failure of capitalism, and look at this big company and just dumps this oil into the Gulf because it wasn't taking sufficient care. But the government passed laws that gave oil companies incentives to drill offshore, farther offshore, in deeper water, where the risk is greater, where it's harder to fix a leak when you get one. In addition to the higher risk of accidents, the cost of solving any problems are greater in 5,000 feet of water than in 250 feet of water. This is from Matthew Novak's article on the Mises website, which you can take a look at. This is a map of the oil wells off the in the Gulf Coast, and you notice they tend to stop about the Florida line. That's another governmental restriction. You might see more oil wells east of that point, but by constraining the permitted area in which you can drill offshore, you're encouraging people to drill further offshore in deeper water where, again, the problems are greater. And if you look at the impact of the tax structure on extracting oil, there was something like a 5 times increase in the amount of oil that companies could pump royalty-free in deep water. From 1995 to 2003, there was something like a 250% increase in the percentage of oil coming from deep water regions of the Gulf because of the way the government taxed oil resources and the way that they distributed these permits for drilling. Another, and this is just one of those well-worn arguments, corporate scandals prove that capitalism doesn't work. Okay, well, so war, government-induced famine, genocide, corporate welfare, political scandal, bribery, corruption, police brutality, deadly regulation, fascism, more war. I mean, that's not a scandal. You compare that to Enron and WorldCom, in which, if I recall, no one got killed, and you want to say that this is somehow, you know, the corporations are really the evil entities out there? And then you've got, of course, the more recent stuff that we've observed, the Benghazi scandal, the IRS scandal, the NSA, and somehow we have to worry about corporations because that's so much worse. And it's sort of like saying, well, the family doesn't work because children misbehave. So let's get rid of the family, because children act up. I have four children, I'm a big fan of the family, but I can definitely attest to that children misbehave. Capitalism is racist and sexist. Well, in a free society, people are allowed to have whatever tastes and preferences they like. There's a freedom of association. But if you ignore productivity in your business in order to favor one group over another, then you're going to pay a price for that. There's a cost to that. Government intervention, on the other hand, can shield people from the real economic consequences of their views. And I point this out in my basic Eco 201 class, the fundamental principles class, and I say, look at the impact of price controls, of rent control. You're putting a ceiling on rents, which means that you're going to have a lot more people who want apartments than there are apartments available. So the landlord is going to be confronted with a long line of people, figuratively, maybe literally, for every available spot. There's not a tendency toward equilibrium if the government's limiting that price. So the landlord's got a lot more choice now. I can fill the apartment with any one of these people in front of me. So if the landlord decides that to exercise preferences based on skin color, religion, handicaps, various other characteristics, then it doesn't really cost anything. The apartment gets filled one way or the other. But if you remove that rent control and prices or rents start to move toward the equilibrium, that means that the landlord now faces the cost of exercising those preferences. So if the landlord says, well, I don't really want you to rent this apartment for me because I don't like your skin color or something, well, there's a much higher chance that that apartment is now going to be vacant, costing the landlord the rent. So the landlord will now have to incur a real financial cost of being a racist. Now, you may not have changed the landlord's fundamental character, you may not have changed the landlord's fundamental preferences, but you have at least imposed a penalty on exercising preferences that are contrary to society that would ignore those irrelevant differences. So government, by imposing rent control, tends to make exercising those racist kinds of ideas more prevalent. There's more to this. I won't go through the details here because I'm short on time. But you can look at a study from the Journal of Economic History by Jennifer Roback on segregation laws, and she finds that in one city after another, private transit companies tried to scuttle segregation laws or simply ignored them. This is cited in an article by Jacoby. I think it's off Cafe Hayek. You can look this up, The Enemies of Jim Crow. You can also find The Economics and Politics of Discrimination by George Leaf, and you can find some more details on this. But basically, Jacoby argues that the owners of municipal transportation systems, private municipal transportation systems, actively resisted segregation because they recognized they would lose money by segregating. So it's not like these people are somehow saintly and they were acting on some kind of higher principle. I mean, maybe some of them were, but segregation hurt their bottom line. The manager of Houston's streetcar company complained to city councilors in 1904 to haul around a good deal of empty space that is assigned to the colored people and not available to both races. He said, this is hurting me as a businessman. In many cities, the company profits were cut into because there were boycotts. Boycotts of streetcars. In Jacksonville, Florida, a 1901 ordinance requiring black passengers to be segregated went unenforced until 1905 when the state legislature mandated segregation statewide. The new statute was passed by the legislature much against the will of the streetcar companies, according to a newspaper there. In fact, the companies were so hostile to the segregation laws that when a group of black citizens challenged the law in court, their attorney felt compelled to deny being in cahoots with the railroad lines in Jacksonville. We're suing, but we're not puppets of this of the railroad interests, because the railroad interests were definitely opposed to the segregation. Well known that this was the case. And again, I encourage you to take a look at the Jacoby article there, where a lot of that information comes from. Finally, or almost finally, capitalism is prone to bubbles and panics. Well, this is kind of the bread and butter of Austrian economics, our business cycle research, and there's a lot of work you can read on this. You can take a look at this book by Greaves, The Causes of the Economic Crisis, Murray Rothbard's classic, America's Great Depression, Bob Murphy's book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and the New Deal. You can look at Tom Wood's book, Meltdown, which became a New York Times bestseller. The bookstore is chock full of stuff on this, and we've had lectures this week on business cycles, so I'm not going to spend more time here. I will mention here another objection is that capitalism leaves important projects undone. So you hear this argument, well, if the government didn't support space exploration, who would? If the government didn't support a space shuttle program, who would? And that's beginning to be refuted by actual practice of private firms that are providing these services of satellite launches and transportation into near space and near orbit and so forth. And not only that, you can just look at the record of a program like the space shuttle system, which was vastly more expensive than was initially projected. I had an article on the Mises Daily from 2011, which you can look up on the space shuttle system, but the NASA estimate was initially that that each launch of the space shuttle was going to be about $7 million, and the actual fact was that it ended up being somewhere around $1.4 to $1.6 billion per launch. That's a few orders of magnitude different, It not only was it expensive, the shuttle ended up being 20% overweight. It was not flying every few weeks as they had expected. It couldn't carry the cargo they had expected. It was just a tremendous problem. Bill Anderson says, we have no evidence that the space program has created on its own any of the new technologies that make our material lives better. Instead, the program has utilized existing technologies. And so the space shuttle program, thankfully, has ended. It was a real waste, apparently, I mean, compared to what private sector firms would have been providing had they not been competing with a heavily subsidized space transport system. Last, we get this argument that capitalism leads to the production of objectionable goods and services. You can take a look at Walter Block's book on this, Defending the Undefendable. Mises says, certainly there are many people who smoke too much and who smoke in spite of the fact that it would be better for them not to smoke. This raises a question far beyond economic discussion. It shows what freedom really means. He says the capitalistic system can be abused and is abused by many people. It's certainly possible to do things which ought not to be done, but a disapproving person always has a way to attempt to change the minds of his fellow citizens. He does not have to try to force them to adopt his own preferences, to avoid things that he disapproves of. I try to make sure that students understand I am not I'm not advocating, in a moral sense, pornography or prostitution or various recreational drugs and that kind of thing. And I certainly discourage those kinds of things from my children. And yet the market provides some of these things. And when the government intervenes in the process, very frequently it makes things worse. Mark Thornton's done lots and lots of work on prohibition and the adverse effects of prohibition. I encourage you to look at that as well. I've just got a few minutes, and I'm sorry this has taken so long. I try to leave more time for questions than ends up happening, but please, now is a great time for some questions. Yes? So you're saying how much intervention should there be before we start saying it's socialism?
Yes.
Yes, I have become increasingly reluctant to refer to the economy of the United States as a free market economy. And the only reason I would continue to do so is if you look at the U.S. relative to other countries, it still tends to be in about the top 20. If you look at that index that I referred to earlier, that index of economic freedom, there may be better ways of evaluating economic freedom, but the U.S. and some other countries in Western Europe and Australia, New Zealand, they tend to be in the top 20. So in a relative sense, yes, we are still a free market system, and I think it's useful to draw that comparison. And you could say, we've got so many trappings of a socialist economy that we're essentially socialist with a little bit of freedom left around the margins. But I still think there's some utility in drawing a distinction between countries like New Zealand or Switzerland and a country like Democratic Republic of the Congo. And so that's... You could argue we're all socialists, but I think that's just a matter of there's no hard and fast line between the two. Other questions? Yes.
At what point would you say that pollution is you can blame it on the government? For example, the EPA, there's this argument that they've decreased pollution, but what could you argue that pollution existed because the government had basically said that water was
Yes. Yes. For the benefit of the recording, I'm going to say the question is, to what extent can you say that the government itself is to blame for pollution? The EPA regulations and so forth have promoted pollution by creating common access resources instead of private property. And that is part of it. By declaring lakes and rivers and California condors off limits to private property, we're encouraging an overuse of those resources, and we're depriving them of the protection that private property provides. And I would add another thing, that the kind of regulation we have, the command and control regulation that seems to be popular now, has replaced to a large extent the tort law that tended to preserve environmental quality prior to the intervention of the EPA and the Forest Fish and Wildlife Services and the other agencies that are charged with preserving the environment. So on several fronts, the government has encouraged pollution rather than diminishing it. And if you look at some things like Superfund sites, toxic waste, hazardous waste sites, look at how many of those are government installations. Armories or military bases or some other kind of government property, and they are a significant fraction of these toxic waste sites. Other questions? Okay, well, thank you very much for your attention.